Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm very honored to have, for the first time on the show, William Gibson, whose new book, Pattern Recognition, was just published by Putnam. Of course, he's the author as well of Neuromancer and a whole series of novels that you all know very well. And I thought we'd talk to him in particular about this one. Now, pattern recognition, that's a term in what field?
When I web searched it, it seemed to turn up everywhere. And I very quickly got the idea that it was somehow, I'd stumbled on something that seemed to be very, very centrally human. And every activity I looked at seemed to involve pattern recognition at one level or another.
How was it defined?
Good question. It's the recognition of patterns, if that isn't a tautology. It's what you need to do to avoid repeating mistakes you've already made. It's what you need to do, usually in therapy, to have any personal growth and get over whatever it is you've been doing that you don't want to do anymore. It's what nations do more than anything else these days in order to ensure their own security. So it's the basis of all intelligence work. It's also the basis of all advertising and all marketing. So it seemed to cover a lot of ground indeed. And I found it when I searched it on Amazon.com, all that turned up were a couple of $200 or $300 mathematics textbooks. So I thought, this is a good place for a novel to be.
Now, when I was reading, I noticed that there are three artist figures in the book. One of them is making a film whose eidetic nature is so intense that people remember what they've seen and are drawn to what they've seen. There is a fan of this film as it appears on the web, a heroine, Case, who is gifted also with the ability to see immediately what will be a meaningful logo, an eye-catching, a successful logo. And then there's a third, older artist who seems to have invented an early form of the computer while in the concentration camp. All three of these people being sort of people who are ahead of trends that follow them and are pre-commodification, because the book seems to be about what happens to people once they are commodified.
Or about the inevitability of commodification, perhaps. I'm not positive. One of those three figures is Kurt Herstark, who is an actual historical figure, who invented a machine that was marketed as the Curta calculator, which was the world's smallest, totally functional mechanical adding machine. And they were manufactured up to the point that the Texas Instruments calculator took over. And I actually stumbled across them. See, a friend of mine who's a dealer in various kinds of antiquities pointed them out to me as being quite remarkable, these tiny thermos-sized and shaped mechanical calculators that look something like very, very elegant hand grenades.
Did he actually invented in a concentration
camp? Yes, he did.
The story in the book
is absolutely accurate historically, except for a few bits that I've put in later as part of the plot about the prototypes and the history of the prototypes and how they enter the collector's market. But he was in Buchenwald, and he did do it all there. And when he was released, he walked away and he built it.
In the book, these three figures for me represent people who are alert before the trends of advertising and trails of information surround them. And each of them, in a way, has a tragic flaw. Nora, the filmmaker, has been horribly hurt in an explosion and is subject to spells of mutism, where it's not just that she doesn't want to talk, she seems unable to. The heroine, Case, has, in addition to her sensitivity to graphic emblems, an oversensitivity to overused graphic emblems,
so that she
has rashes and things when mm-hmm. she sees certain trademarks. It seems, and of course this progenitor of the early calculator is destined to obscurity. And his work is tracked, I guess, by an alcoholic who lives in a gypsy caravan. But it does seem as if these artists or creative figures, if they are not quickly lionized or victimized by their cultures, they get hurt and discarded. Is that your view of the artist and the culture?
Well, I think I'd be inclined. I'm not sure. My experience, sort of my life experience of watching artists, has been that the ones who get sidelined in terms of conventional success are sometimes the lucky ones, and sometimes not. It doesn't seem to be, to me, it doesn't seem as though the conventional idea of artistic success or failure necessarily applies either way. You can find happy people on either side of the fence and unhappy people on either side of the fence. It seems to depend on something else, and I'm not sure what.
Now, I may be being heretical to say this, but it seems to me, and I'm talking to William Gibson, who, although I did not say so in my introduction, is the coiner of the term cyberspace and has had a huge impact on the writing of science fiction, but also on the thinking about the interaction between science trends and culture and web trends and culture. What I was curious about is that this does not seem like science fiction to me at all. There are a couple of aphasic-like struggles that the characters have with different inputs, but by and large, this is not a novel of the supernatural or the post-natural. It seems to me to be an accurate description of a world.
Exactly. It's a piece of contemporary mimetic fiction that involves at most two minor but inherently fantastic bits of business, each of which is more like Central American magic realism than what we think of as science fiction or the sort of science fiction that I've always been associated with. The interesting thing about this is that I've already run into, case-hardened readers of mine who haven't even noticed that this book is actually set in the recent past. It's set in the summer of 2002, so it's set in the past, but it feels, to them and to me, very much like the other novels I've written. And I think that is That is because, in some way, this is what I've always been doing, but I've in this novel, I've just become overt. And I haven't bothered to drape the contemporary with scarves of faux futurity.
I read in your biographical note, your autobiographical note, something that truly fascinated me. You quote Gene Wolfe saying that if both of your parents die, if you're an only child mm-hmm. and both of your parents die while you're still a teenager, that this seems in some way to be a prerequisite for being a novelist, that there's often a trauma that involves the reconstruction of what he calls an Atlantis-like past, and that this seems to be what artists do. And I was fascinated by this. Do you think it's true?
Well, I think you've actually run
two together,
because one is Wolf's likening being the only child and survivor to being the sole survivor of Atlantis. And Brian Aldiss's idea, which is probably not unique at all to Brian Aldiss, but it's where I first ran across it, of the artistic impulse proceeding from traumatic breaks, as Aldiss calls them. And I think I ran into that Aldiss essay in the 70s, and it was the first time I'd run across that sort of thought, although it's since become much more familiar and widespread an idea. I'm not sure. I think that my own creativity was either somehow engendered in that. Well, no. I think there was something there even before my father's death. When I was a little kid, I was a very imaginative kid and somewhat withdrawn. But these early traumas torque it somehow into something else. What might have manifested in a less twisted child in me became an obsession with writing. Someone else might have just gone out and slashed tires and be done with it.
Well, I'm curious, because you mentioned the 70s, that this is the time of that essay. But for me, it was the time when both fiction and science fiction were becoming almost supernaturally exciting. It seemed like every week when I'd go to the drugstore, because they were still mass-market paperbacks, you'd find Stand on Zanzibar by John Brunner mm-hmm. or the new Philip Jose Farmer or the new Samuel Delaney. And your work seems to come from that ferment where the cutting edge of fiction and science fiction, there was an obligation to include a new idea or a new way of contemplating reality. Mm-hmm. Has that been important to you? And are those writers of significance to you?
Well, when I began, for whatever reason, I began to try to write fiction, and specifically to try to market the fiction I wrote as to the science fiction genre markets, I had this really like sharp resentment toward the current state of science fiction. And that was sort of in the very late 70s, very early 80s. And it was as though the bluegrass or the mountain blues of my childhood had been turned into Shania Twain. Like I felt that this like intense subculture that had nurtured me as a kid and fed me all this like high octane crazy, crazy stuff by Delaney and by Phil Farmer and by Bruner and many others, I felt that that had been taken over by people who just as easily could have been dental technicians.
Right.
Something, there'd been this terrible blanding and productizing of something that I had this romantic idea. I'd had this romantic impression as a kid that you had to be crazy to write this stuff.
Yes.
You know, that you had to be driven. You had to be absolutely driven and mad to write this stuff. Because I knew that these guys didn't make a lot of money. That was sort of evident from the look of the magazines. And I knew them as people who'd been doing this all their lives, that, you know, that started as teenagers and they'd done it all their lives and they hadn't made them wealthy. They just kept doing it. So I thought of it as something that was like that people came to out of a sense of vocation and that they just had to do it. And the stuff that was in the drugstores when I started writing was just like it struck me as being a total affront to that. So when I started, I felt like I was on a kind of kamikaze mission that nobody was going to notice what I did anyway because it was completely counter to what the market seemed to be going for.
But didn't that happen, in a sense, to the whole culture? Because it seems to me, we grew up roughly the same time. You're 4 years older than I am. That the culture was, in a way, supercharged between 1966 and 1972, that it gradually fell asleep again, that by the time you were writing, you were in a period of the inert.
Yeah.
And writing needed to be woken up again, but there was no sign that there was any contingent capable of doing so. Were you confident in that ability?
I thought that it would be ignored. And when I wrote Neuromancer, part of the freedom I found to do that was that I thought, nobody's going to notice this thing. It's a paperback original. It's actually going to, this is like firing a lone torpedo into this vast and hostile navy that won't even notice its impact. But I had this attitude like, okay, this one's for Mike Moorcock and the British New Wave. And it actually, the amazing thing was, there was this echo coming back. Like I started with a few short stories. And when the short stories were published, I started getting these weird echoes back. Like people I'd never heard of were sending me postcards and saying, "That's cool. We saw what you did." And like they knew what I was doing. Like they could see the particular color of freak flag that I was attempting to fly. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea they were out there. Any of these people were out there. And they also, to my delight, they tended to be like 10 or 15 years younger than I was. But to have we could talk 60s science fiction and avant-garde.
I'm speaking to William Gibson, the author most recently of Pattern Recognition, and you're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Now, it sounds as if Philip K. Dick was in many ways the prototype for this kind of feverish, driven, impoverished, paranoiac guru figure. Was he one for you?
No, he wasn't, and that's an odd thing. Like Raymond Chandler, as with Raymond Chandler, he's someone who people associate me with or associate my writing with, but actually never was that much of an influence. I think that I was getting the vitamins that other people get from reading Phil Dick, from reading Thomas Pynchon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I was by reading Thomas Pynchon, I think I was actually getting the organic version of the vitamins.
Now, I want to talk about Pynchon because he was an absolute level of fascination for me at the time and still. And, you know, they were very much, V had come out, The Crying of Lot 49 mm-hmm. was very recent. I think I read it in hardcover, as I did Gravity's Rainbow in that rare hardcover edition. But Pynchon seems to be, in a certain way, inimitable, by which I think I mean that he seems so smart that to go up against him almost requires that you know more than he does, and it seems impossible to. Did he represent a kind of wall for you? Was that a challenge?
No, I never thought of myself as trying to do Pynchon in the way that I've never thought of myself as trying to do Borges, who's an equally inimitable writer, and one who I value at least as much as I value Pynchon, maybe more as I get older. I find everything in Borges is so concise and infinitely deep. But I saw what Pynchon could do. Somehow I got what Pynchon could do with a couple of technical histories from World War II. Somehow I got how he could go into that stuff and find this endless resource of poetry where someone else would just see this clunky book. And that was, I think, the most important thing for me, that how he seemed to find the beauty in all the kipple of the industrial world.
Now, I was very pleased in answer to a question about 9/11, because the book is sort of situated with 9/11 as a kind of beginning point. You said, I'm not looking for answers. I'm looking for questions.
Yeah.
And I noticed also on the web, having been asked to read at a mystery bookstore, you say, okay, well, it's shooting distance. It's a book about a mystery.
Yeah.
And I'm very interested in that, because it is about a mystery. There isn't solution going on here.
Yeah.
It's a report on a kind of process that doesn't ask the reader to participate in solutions. In fact, questions are what the book is better at. And I wondered if you could talk a bit about that, because it seems central.
Well, I've taken it for granted that didacticism is not a higher function of the novel. And that, in fact, I believe that a didactic novel can't be a very good novel. And consequently, I believe, as a dear old Marxist professor of mine believed at the University of British Columbia, that a fascist can't write a good novel. I think you had a pretty good case for that, because you can't write a really high didactic. You have to be willing to let go to write a good novel, if you believe what, say, Forster believed. And although that gets very political, because then some people would argue about who's didactic and who's not. And I only know from my own... I can only know from my own experience that I'm not setting out to prove a point or illustrate an agenda. So all I can do is try to create a text that generates questions. But I've learned from I've learned through this process that for me it's about generating the questions. It's not about answers. The answers aren't, they may be important to each of us, but my answers won't be the answers that the reader may find. And my answers change. It's my, if I have a set of questions, you know, 20 questions, answer them this week, answer them next year. Like some of the answers will be different. And it's because I'm like still alive. And that's what happens.
It does seem to me, though, that many people look at your books as if they were puzzles on the one hand, or blueprints for critical theory on the other. And it does seem to me that in a certain way, when fiction, contemporary fiction, as well as science fiction, fell asleep, you know, when suddenly we got minimalism instead of the crazy maximalism that Pynchon and others had been perfecting, suddenly what stepped into the breach was theory. And theory seems to be a particular enemy in this book.
Yes. Well, I think you're the first person to have pointed that out, that all the really bad people in this book seem to be like structuralists or Baudrillard fans or something. And, you know, I don't know. It just seemed to fit. I know that often when I've been most despairing over the past quarter of a century or so, it's been when I've been confronted with theory as an entity. I just go to sleep. Like, there's nothing. I don't know what it is. There's just nothing there for me. It just sounds like a big hairball of words, and it's just not where I go.
I've been speaking to William Gibson, the author most recently of Pattern Recognition. It's published by Putnam. They've been publishing his work in hardcover for some time. Thank you very much for joining me, Bill.
Thank you.
You can read the first chapter of Pattern Recognition on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistants from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book, off the mouse, pop, die.